Currently, we're looking at how to develop an effective short-term strategy to help us avoid or reduce the impact of this process here. And we're looking at stage five now, where we've talked about the fact that we've acted on our mental afflictions, we've maybe done something harmful. What can we do to avoid experiencing the result of those, the ripening of that imprint of a suffering experience? And we said that there are four things we can do, called the four opponent powers, to purify our mind of negative imprints and negative tendencies. First one is have sincere regret for having done that negative action. The second step, where we just finished, was reliance foundation, meaning to reaffirm the positive direction that we are following, want to follow our life. And here, of course, in the context of mind training, or Lojong, which is part of the Mahayana tradition or vehicle, then usually that takes the form of going for refuge and generating bodhicitta. That is our foundation or platform that we are working with in the Mahayana. Then the third thing on the four opponent powers is remedy. Is think of some sort of practical remedy for the negative behavior we did. And here, of course, it's very helpful to do something directly positive opposite. For example, if we verbally abuse someone at work, then a remedy could be simply apologize. So do something directly positive opposite. Sometimes that's not, for whatever reason, not possible to do something directly positive opposite. Then what we can do is do any virtuous activity with a motivation of wishing to overcome that negative habit. That can be also very helpful. The ultimate remedy for all negative behavior, of course, is emptiness. Because all negative imprints are based on ignorance. So by coming to realize emptiness, we can wipe out all negative imprints, negative habits in our mind. So that's the long-term remedy. But the short-term, we can do practical, positive opposite action. And the fourth point of the four opponent powers is resolve. Make a strong determination not to do that negative behavior again. And here we need to be practical. If the habit, the negative behavior, is something we do, we have a strong habit and do very regularly, there's no point in saying, I'm never going to do this again because it's not going to happen. So therefore, pick an amount of time that with effort you can normally manage. So you can say, maybe for the next day I'm not going to do that thing. If that's way too difficult, for the next hour I'm not going to do that thing. If that's way too difficult, for the next 5 minutes I'm not going to do that thing. Pick an amount of time with effort, normally you manage, and then you can slowly extend it from 5 to 10 minutes to 15 minutes to an hour, a day, a week, a month, a year, the rest of a life. In that way, we can even start to break very strong negative habits. So if we do all of those four things with respect to any negative behavior we've done, that can really purify our mind of that imprint and purify the mind of the negative tendency. So very effective procedure. And you're going to be doing a little four opponent powers purification exercise in a few days' time with Renato. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later in the text. It comes up again later in the text.
Can you explain again why the best remedy, the ultimate remedy for what would be emptiness?
Because all actions are based on mental afflictions, and the mental afflictions are coming from ignorance. So if we wipe out ignorance, we wipe out the mental afflictions and the imprints that they produce. Okay. But let's say we didn't manage to do anything here, and now we're at step six. So now step six, we're currently experiencing the result. So here I want to focus only on if we're experiencing some sort of suffering result. We're having currently some sort of suffering experience. Can we do anything in the moment to reduce the impact of that suffering experience? Or there's nothing to do?
We can accept it, and we can try even to dedicate the suffering to others. I mean,
very good.
My karma, and then
the very good. Very good. Very good. But before I talk a bit more about what you've said, there's one other point, is that also here, impermanence can be helpful, particularly coarse impermanence. You know, that to understand that this too shall pass. Because often when we're suffering, we sort of hold on to it, like, oh, no, no, that's so terrible, it's going to last forever, oh, no, no, no. I remember I used to sort of do this well before I became into Buddhism, that if I had some sort of quite heavy suffering, I'd sometimes think, oh, tomorrow will be different. And already that thought sort of made it a bit more bearable, because, okay, tomorrow is going to be different.
Yeah, I want to ask about resolve.
Resolve.
Yeah, resolve.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So, if it's habit, and on the intellectual way, we can, tell, okay, I'll not do this for 1 hour, yeah? But it takes a lot of energy, like willpower, and it exhausts. And it's only intellectual. If we go farther, if we understand we don't need to do this again, but we can understand this only from inside, and it will, go by naturally.
Yeah. So remember, this is part of the short-term strategy. The long-term strategy, of course, is this. The long-term strategy is to go back here and to understand the mental afflictions and the ignorance and work at that. And then, of course, if they go, then the habit goes automatically. It's gone. It can't be there. So this is the longer-term strategy. But the short-term strategy, and we need to work on both together.
But it takes energy, a lot of energy.
Yeah, of course. But to develop your long-term strategy could take quite some time. And if we keep engaging in the harmful behaviour, that's going to interfere with us implementing a long-term strategy. We're going to get blocked because we're doing a lot of negative things now. So we need to do whatever we can to subdue them a little bit in the short term, and that's to do this. And then while we're doing that, to work on the longer-term strategy, we need to do both of them together, and then we can do something. Okay. And then the point here about what to do at step 6 is, again, what we talked briefly about before, acceptance. And acceptance here, again, doesn't mean resignation. Acceptance simply means, in the present moment, I'm experiencing some sort of unpleasant, painful, suffering experience. I can either accept that fact, or I can try and resist it in terms of having aversion. And so if we don't practice acceptance, usually what we do is we go, oh, no, not that again. Go away, go away, go away, go away. And we just have aversion to it. And aversion to our unpleasant experiences, all of that does is it magnifies the amount of suffering we experience. And that was highlighted in a study I read recently, saw recently. They did this study about pain. They had people in a group, they had applied on their leg, they had it was some sort of heat pad that produced a lot of heat, so it was quite painful on the leg. And they asked them to rate their level of pain from 0 to 100. 100 the highest. And initially the average level that was reported was 66, was the level of pain. And at the same time, they had an intravenous drip into their arm. And initially, they just had saline solution going in, so nothing. But then what they did was they started introducing painkiller without telling anyone, and they kept asking people, how much pain are you experiencing? So, of course, when they started putting painkiller in, you'd expect them to start reporting less. And they did. It went down from 66 to 55. Then they still kept giving them painkiller, but the only difference now was they told them, you're getting painkiller. So they didn't change anything, just said, now you're getting painkiller. So it should have stayed the same, but actually it went from 55 down to 39. And then what they did was they kept giving them painkiller, but now they said, we're stopping pain killing, expect pain. So it should have stayed the same because nothing changed. But instead of 39, it went back to 64. 64. So therefore, what we can see from that is a lot of the suffering they were experiencing was through aversion. They didn't want it. They thought, oh, I'm going to have pain. I don't want that. So then they reported much more suffering. So therefore, if we can practice acceptance, we can avoid the aversion. And then we can follow some good advice from great Indian master Shantideva from the 8th century. He says, if something can be remedied, why get upset? Just fix it. And if a situation cannot be remedied, what's the point in getting upset? Doesn't help. So with acceptance, we can go, okay, can I fix this? Yes, okay, fix it. No, I can't fix it. It too shall pass. And in at least that way, you won't magnify the amount of suffering you experience. But there's one more thing we can do, and is also mentioned in the answer here. And this is what's going to come up again and again in this text, a little bit later in the next section, is if we are having some suffering experience, often then we become very self-absorbed. We very just focus on me, 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 poor me, poor me, poor me. And then, of course, together with that comes the aversion and then more suffering. So on top of practicing acceptance, what can be very helpful is not to become self-absorbed, but to focus outward. And what we can do here, and this is going to be mentioned a number of places in the text coming, is that we can understand that I'm not the only one who's got some suffering experience in the world at the moment. There must be thousands and thousands of other people who've got something similar than me now. So by me willingly taking on all their suffering, may they be free of theirs. So of course, this is compassion. So then we can use this difficult situation as an opportunity to develop compassion. And often what you will find, and studies show this as well, is that if we then focus on others and really do this sort of practice, which is a sort of a variation of what's called Tong Len, which we're going to look at quite a lot in the text coming, then not only is it we are making a difficult situation for us meaningful, but often doing that practice often even subdues the discomfort we experience as well. So this is going to be talked about quite a lot in the text coming. So this is what we can do at step 6. Practice acceptance. If we can fix it, fix it. If we can't, at least don't have aversion to it. And then on top of that, we can do this sort of Tong Len exercise and use that difficult situation to develop loving kindness and compassion for others. Okay, so that's the short-term strategies that we can work on. But of course, here in the text, we're talking about the long-term strategy. And the long-term strategy, of course, is to overcome ignorance through the wisdom practice, the Vipassana practice. And so then in the section of the text, we'll go back to the text now. And again, that slogan, train to view all phenomena as dreamlike, on page 3 on the right side. And what we saw was that to make sense or meaning out of the world of our experience, we have to, because we just receive a mass of data, we have to draw lines around various collections of data, and we have to create objects and then give them names so we can communicate. So basically we are line drawers and we are continually improving our ability to draw lines. When we're a very young child, a baby, very difficult to draw even basic lines. And even now sometimes we have difficulty drawing lines. When we get into a new situation, an unfamiliar situation, we look in front of us and we go, what's that? We don't even know if it's one thing, a collection of things. We don't know how to draw the line. So we struggle on how to draw a line to create some sort of object or meaning. So we're continually improving that so that we can better and better interact in the world. So again, there's no problem with this. We have to do this. If we don't do this, we can't function. The problem is that we turn these lines that we draw into boundaries. We believe that the world is already divided up into many separate, discrete things. And seeing the world in that way, of course, we see the consequences of that in this chart that we've looked at. Now, generally in our experiences, the very first line we draw is we draw a line around here and we create the experiencer because there's single experience. And in single experience, there are two aspects. There's experiencer and experienced. And we have to distinguish those two elements of the single experience. Otherwise, no meaning. And I think a newborn baby can't even really do that very well at all. So we have to learn how to correctly distinguish experiencer from experienced. So we draw the line, give the name. So we have to do that. Otherwise, can't function. Again, the problem is that we don't realize that's what's going on. We believe that there's already an independent me here and an independent world of experience. So we've turned this line into a boundary. And we identify with, we grasp onto the me part of the experience and see ourselves as independent of the experienced. But that way of seeing ourselves is completely illogical. Completely illogical. Like the analogy is this big. You can't have big on its own. It's just illogical. You can only have big relative to small. You can't have big and small. They only exist codependently. Likewise, you can only have up with down, in with out. Likewise, you can only have me relative to not me. You can only have experiencer relative to experienced. You can only have subject relative to object. But what we do, of course, is we grasp on to the me part of the experience and believe that we're independent of the experience. But that self-grasping belief in an independent me is like saying this is big. I mean, just makes no sense whatsoever.
It's a little unclear about me and not me. About experience and experience, it's clear, but about me and not me.
But you can only have pen relative to not pen. Mm-hmm. In fact, the way, and this is a very big topic, but the way in which we know things is through double negative. We know pen as being not pen. That's how we actually understand things. For example, when a young child, you know, the mother's trying to teach the young child things, and they've maybe got a pet dog, and the mother points and goes, dog, dog, dog. And then the child looks there and sees a thing with four things sticking down and goes, dog, thing with four things sticking down. And then it sees a table and goes, dog, dog, dog. And mother goes, no, no, table, table. And then the child refines that idea. Oh, not just four things sticking down, but it moves. And then the cat goes past, dog, dog, dog. No, no, cat, cat, cat. And so then it refines even more the idea of dog. Four things sticking down, it moves, but it has a different thing looking out, sticking out the end of it. And then it refines its idea of dog. So the child, like us, we know things as being not that. It's through double negation that we actually know things. So, like that, is you can only have me with respect to not me. So that not me, of course, can be you, the world, whatever. Subject, object, experience, or experience, like that. So what we do, of course, is we contract around the me part of the experience. We grasp onto this as if it exists independently from the experienced. But that's completely illogical. So we are completely out of sync with the interdependent nature of reality. So we are basing our behavior from that perspective of independent me. So we are completely out of sync with reality. So we're fighting against reality. And if we fight against reality, we have mental afflictions, we suffer, and often the people around us suffer as well. And very often, in our behavior, we have a very strong focus on the agent, on me. Me, me, me. It's me going there. Me saying this. Me doing it. It's always me, 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 with this self-grasping. So very often, our self-grasping is very strong. The stronger the self-grasping, the more out of sync we are. The more potential for mental afflictions and suffering. But sometimes in our behavior, this self-grasping is not as strong. And that's often the case when we're more focused on the activity rather than the me who's doing the activity. And this often happens, for example, when we're, for example, absorbed in watching a good program on TV, absorbed in reading a good book, absorbed in fixing a problem at work. In those occasions, we're more focused on the activity rather than the me who's doing the activity. So the self-grasping is not as strong. And we know from our own experience on those occasions, things seem to flow a lot better. Time seems to go quite quickly. Why? Because we're not fighting so much against reality. We're a little bit more in harmony with reality because the self-grasping is a little bit less. This is very much exemplified in people who have developed high level of focus in their activities. People like professional athletes, professional musicians, who have spent thousands and thousands of hours training in their activity and have developed a high level of focus in their activity. And so often when they're doing their activity, they even often report that they're in the zone or the flow state. And they often report there was no sense of me. There was just the activity happening. There was just the music playing. And not only that, they also report peak performance, optimum performance. Why? Because they're much more in sync with reality. Because the self-grasping is very much reduced due to the force of their concentration. But this, of course, is only temporarily reducing self-grasping through concentration. Here, of course, in Vipassana practice, we're talking about eliminating self-grasping altogether through wisdom. So if we can come to realize emptiness, we can come to realize that there's no boundary here. There's no independent me, independent world. In fact, we'll come to realize there's not one single boundary in the entire universe. And through realizing that, we'll be able to realize, we'll be able to develop boundless love and compassion for others. And this is actually a measure of how our practice is going. If we're really going well in our emptiness practice and realizing there's no boundary anywhere, particularly there's no boundary, there's not me here and them there as something separate, what you'll find is that even without thinking about it, more spontaneously, you'll feel much more connected with others, more spontaneously kind and compassionate to others, because there's no gap or distance or separation between us and others. So this is a measure that our emptiness practice is going well, that we have this sense of closeness. And often we say that loving kindness is the expression of emptiness. That is the expression of emptiness. So What you'll find also here, we're talking about the two bodhicittas, the ultimate bodhicitta, conventional bodhicitta. Ultimate bodhicitta is this wisdom of emptiness. When we get to a certain level of that practice, particularly when we start talking Tantra Vajrayana, we start talking about the very subtle mind, then conventional bodhicitta spontaneously arises out of that state. But of course, us as beginners are not at that level. So for us as beginners, we need to cultivate these two aspects individually. We need to work on the emptiness, Vipassana practice, and we need to work on the bodhicitta, the compassion practice individually. But as we get to a certain point in the path, we'll see that actually compassion, loving kindness, and bodhicitta is the natural expression of emptiness. But we're not quite there yet, so maybe we need to work individually. You had a question?
Yeah, how can I see that there is no boundary?
In meditation, to realize that in meditation. That is the Vipassana practice. Of course, intellectually, you know, it doesn't take much to understand, well, they can only exist dependently, there's no big and small, you know, so intellectually that doesn't take too much thinking. And so even intellectually we can think, well, okay, there has to be together, there can only be experiencer with respect to experience, subject, object. So intellectually maybe we can go, yeah, that seems to make sense, but again, that's not enough, because our behavior is not driven by our intellectual understanding. It's driven by instinctive habit. And instinctively, we're grasping onto independent me, independent world. And so, therefore, we need to come to directly realize there's no boundary. And that is the Vipassana practice. The emptiness experience is an experience of no boundary. But, of course, we need to meditate and come to that experience ourselves. Otherwise, this whole idea of emptiness and dependent arising is just another theory, which may or may not be true and may or may not help us. So we need to test it, check it.
I have a question. Often, social workers and also teachers or doctors, they get into a state of being really focused in their job, you know, and really like, they don't even, you know, sometimes even look at other things except for what they are doing. But then, you know, often you can, when you finish your job, like take a vacation, you know, you get sick and all of this, you know, out of. So I was wondering, you know, in one way you are very, 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 you know, into your job, like in a sort of, you know, not looking at yourself at all and very focused in that. But in the other way, I mean, you kind of get a burnout, in a way. And I was wondering, because, you know, there's like saying that when you get into a higher level, you can function even without sleeping, you know, and stuff like that.
Sure.
Yeah. So how can you, in a way, balance it? I mean,
well, again, probably, you know, when we talk about them highly focused, often still there's a lot of tension in the focus. And they focus like that for some hours and they get completely exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. At the end of the day, completely exhausted. So again, there's still this tension in the focus. So that's one thing that we need to work on, is to reduce as in the shamatha, the basis is relaxation. So one thing that can help immediately is to work on developing relaxation as a basis for the focus in their life. So that's a sort of a very basic level. But then, of course, all of these activities are coming through grasping, you know. They're virtuous activities, trying to help in that, but still there's self-grasping there. And so therefore, with that self-grasping, of course, comes then mental afflictions as well. So this creates problems as well. So therefore, not only do we need to work on the relaxation as a basis for more sustainable focus, but we need to work on overcoming this self-grasping, which leads to mental afflictions and can often lead to self-cherishing. You know, look at me, how much wonderful work I'm doing for others. Did you notice that? You know, you need to praise me because I'm so wonderful. I'm helping others. Are you? I mean, yeah, it can happen, no? No? And so these sorts of things, of course, are going to create a lot of stress in people's lives. And then, of course, what happens then is that they lose the compassion for themselves and wisdom for themselves, because this mental affliction is not allowing that to happen. So therefore, if we work on those elements, basically the elements of wisdom and compassion at whatever level, if we can work on those together with the relaxation, then you'll find that one is they won't get so exhausted doing the same amount of work because they're not so tense. Mm-hmm. And secondly, they'll start to really look after themselves, be kind and compassionate to themselves, and rest when they need to rest, and not get frustrated when they can't help someone because they're not able to. All of these things will improve. And so then they'll be able to do more sustainable help of themselves and others without burnout. So this is important.
When you're talking about relaxation, you mean only meditation or like...
Well, of course, everything is two parts, you know, daily life and meditation. You know.
Yeah, because there is also people, you know, tell them, okay, you're tense, now do meditation. And then they're like, I mean...
But again, usually the problem is that in modern day world, you know, there's so much stress and tension, and then they say, oh, just meditate a bit. But that's like taking one thing out of the whole framework and saying, here's the pill that will fix your problems. It won't.
Yeah.
It won't fix it. Maybe temporarily they feel a bit more relaxed, but then 30 minutes later they're back in the same state because they've got no framework. And unfortunately, this is what is often happening in our modern society. They're drawing often on Buddhism, and they go, oh, that mindfulness thing in Buddhism, that's pretty good, I'll take that. Mm-hmm. Here, take the mindfulness pill and then everything will be fixed. And it won't be. Of course it won't be. Because you still got your bad habits, you've got your mental afflictions, you've got all of these things happening. Mindfulness is not going to fix that.
Yeah.
So we need a framework.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that gets sort of thrown out.
Yeah.
You know, oh, that other stuff, that's religious stuff. No, no, get rid of that. Ethics? Oof, no, religious. Oof, throw that out. Mindfulness, that's it. Take the mindfulness pill, everything will be solved. It won't be. I mean, you're kidding yourself. And in fact, unfortunately, what's happening in the corporate world, some of the people who are not so good motivated, the corporate bosses go, oh, mindfulness, I'll give this to the employees. Mm-hmm. They'll be able to have less stress. They'll be able to even work longer hours and do more for me. Disaster. I mean, it's a complete disaster. This is what's called, there's a phrase coined some years ago, McMindfulness. Fast food mindfulness. I mean, completely unhealthy. I mean, and that's unfortunately what's happening a lot in the corporate world. Mindfulness, yes, let's give them mindfulness so they can get less stress, work more hours, and then, of course, it's a disaster. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, I need to write this down.
I mean, it's ridiculous. McMindfulness. I mean, it really is. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of the corporate mindfulness, not all, there are some. In fact, I'm working in an organization that's bringing mindfulness in the corporate sector, and they're doing it in a very good way. But a lot of it is really McMindfulness. It's fast food mindfulness, you know, the quick fix, so that the employees can be more pacified. They don't complain so much and do more work. And I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, unfortunately, that's what's happening.
And then the long term is just becoming worse.
Mm. Yeah. Okay.
It's about when I say I am doing something, for instance, I'm looking at the flowers. It's just the way to say it, because the looking happens through these eyes, this body, and there is no me.
There is a you.
But me looking at flowers. So it's like, in a way, there is one unity, and I divide just flowers and the one who is looking at flowers. And action happens. It is like this?
No.
No?
No. Not really. I mean, it's... No. There's no Buddhist tradition that says there's no me. There is some disagreement in terms of how I exist and the world exists amongst the various Buddhist philosophical systems, but they're all in agreement that there is a me, there are flowers, there are actions, these things exist. It's just a matter of knowing how these things exist. And that's what we're going to be looking at right now, in fact. So your question's leading into the point here. So two things I'd like to talk about now. One is that here in this text, when it's talking about Vipassana practice, it's talking about first looking at phenomena as objects. I think it says the initial meditation on the absence of intrinsic existence of perceived objects. So it talks about objects and then it talks about subjects. This is the next part coming. But very often, and when it talks about subjects here, as we're going to see, it's talking about the mind. It's talking about the perceiver, the mind. And Geshe Chikawa, who was put this together, these 7 points, he had a lot of influence from the Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism. And both in the Nyingma and Kagyu, when they talk about Vipassana practice, they really talk about nature of the mind practice. So there's a lot of emphasis in our Vipassana practice of observing the mind. And that's a little bit what we did in this morning's meditation, 9 o'clock. And so this is what the flavour you have a little bit coming up in the text. But more traditionally, and this is coming from the great Indian masters such as Nagarjuna, Chandrakirti and so forth, when we first embark in the Vipassana practice and we investigate the nature of reality, then it's very much recommended we begin by looking at ourselves as a person. Because it's this grasping onto independent me is the beginning of the problems, is that grasping onto independent me. And I think you did this with Renato already yesterday afternoon, a little bit of an emptiness practice looking for me, the person. So I'd just like to sort of briefly lay out one standard way that we can do this Vipassana practice, investigating how do I exist. And I think this was the approach you used with Renato yesterday afternoon. And here I'm using terminology from a book by His Holiness Dalai Lama called How to See Yourself as You Really Are. And that's generally the book I recommend as a beginning book to read about this Vipassana practice of emptiness and understand a little bit more about dependent arising and ignorance and so forth. And he uses this terminology because he also explains these 4 essential points in that book, identifying the target. In the technical word that's often used here is identifying the object of negation. So what this first step is about, and this is the most important point, if we get this right, the rest is a lot easier. If we get this wrong, then nothing works. And here is we grasp onto independent me. We have instinctively the sense that there's an independent me here, independent world there. And that's the basis of our experience. Our experience is on the basis of independent me. Me doing this, me saying this. So if the me really does exist independently, if it does exist from its own side, it must be findable. So what we're going to do in the meditation, what you did in the meditation as well yesterday, is to look for the me that seems to be here. But if you're going to look for the me that seems to be here, it'd be a good idea to have a clear picture of that me. For example, if we're going to look for a particular person in a crowded room to know whether they're there or not, it'd be a good idea to have a clear picture of the person to start with. Because if you don't have a clear picture of what the person looks like, you can look in the room all day and you won't come up to a conclusion if they're there or not. You keep searching, and nothing really, you don't come to a conclusion because you didn't have a clear picture to begin with. Similarly here, if we don't have a clear picture of how we see ourselves existing, and then we search, it'll be inconclusive. We can search all day and not come to a conclusion whether there is an independent me or not. It's not going to happen. So we need to get a clear picture of how we see ourselves existing. And very often in our behaviour, we have a strong sense of a me. But often when we sit down to meditate and we relax the body, we relax the mind, then often this strong sense of me sort of subsides. So then as a beginner, often it's recommended at the beginning to get a clear picture, is at the beginning of meditation, think of a situation where there's a strong sense of me. So maybe think of a situation where someone is criticizing you for something you never did. Or think of a situation where someone's praising you for something. In those sorts of situations, there's usually a very strong sense of me. I'm so good. How dare you criticize me? And generally, there's a very strong sense of me. That's the me, of course, on which we behave and react. And that me really does seem to completely exist from its own side. It doesn't seem to depend on anything else to exist. That's the me we need to look for. And this is also, so we need a clear picture, and then we need to look for that me that seems to be here. Now, this also is another point where people go astray in this practice, is that when we do the search, then often, as I mentioned a little bit at the beginning of the meditation I led this morning, often the mistake people do is they turn it into an intellectual exercise. And then, of course, we always come up with an answer, because all of us have some sort of belief system based on what we've heard and read and so forth in our life. So we all sort of have some sort of belief system in who we think we are. And so, of course, if we've studied some Buddhism and we sort of accept that, then our intellectual mind will say, the me is the subtle mental continuum, because that's what goes from life to life. That's me. That's the real me, is the subtle mental continuum, if we've studied Buddhism. If we've studied some more New Age stuff, maybe we've come to the conclusion, oh, everything in the universe is subtle energy, so I'm just subtle energy. Or I'm aura. And then so when we do this meditation, the intellectual mind, instead of looking directly, the intellectual mind goes, I know the answer, I know. I'm the subtle mental continuum, don't need to look any further. I'm subtle energy, that's me, don't need to look any further. And then, of course, the whole practice stops. But if we're getting angry at someone, are we identifying with subtle energy as me? Are we identifying as a subtle mental continuum as me, the me that's getting angry? I don't think so. I don't think so. So we, again here, we need to be, if the intellectual mind starts to come into this meditation and goes, I know the answer, you just throw it out the window. Because we're not interested in our intellectual understanding here. We're looking at empirical evidence. We want to look directly in experience what's really there, not based on our belief systems. The second point is called limiting the possibilities. The technical word often mentioned here is establishing the pervasion. And here is to understand, where do we have to look? If there is an independent me, where do we look? And if there is an independent me that exists from its own side, there are only two places it could possibly be. Either it's the same as the body and the mind, or different than the body and the mind. So that's where we need to search. The same as the body and the mind, or different than the body and the mind. And if we don't find that me in either of those two places, it doesn't exist. So that's the second point. Limiting the possibilities. What are the search places I need to look? Because if we don't look everywhere, then we may look somewhere and we go, it's not there, but well, maybe it's somewhere else. And then no conclusion. So we need to know, where do we look? So that we, if we look in all of those places and we don't find, it doesn't exist. Then we do the search. So again, it can only, if it exists, the independent me, it must be findable either as the same as the body and the mind or different than the body and the mind. And so we can search those two places in either order. Usually we do it in the order that, is it the same as the body and the mind? Is it different than the body and the mind? Same as the body and mind, of course, then we look in the body and the mind for the me and see if we can find the me anywhere within the body and the mind. If we don't find the me in the body and the mind, then the only place it could be otherwise is different, which would mean that we must be able to take away the body and the mind and be left with the me. And if there's no me left over, if we take the body and the mind away, then there's no me separate or different than the body and the mind. And so if we do this search and we get to the point of not finding, then that not finding experience is an experience of emptiness. And we hold that experience as long as we can. That now becomes the object of our shamatha practice. That not finding experience is the object of shamatha now. Hold that as long as we can. Allow it to penetrate deeper into the mind. Now, what often happens in this practice, as I mentioned, two things already. First, often what happens is we don't have a clear picture, and then we just search, and then we just get confused because we're not sure. The other thing that often happens is we may have a clear picture, but then the intellectual mind comes in and goes, no, 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 you don't need to search. I know the answer. The answer is this. And then we're happy with that. So that's not the practice either. And then the other thing that often happens is if we don't mistakenly do those two things, if we have a clear picture and we do the search well and we get to the point where we don't seem to be able to find that me that seems to be here, then often what people do is they misinterpret this not finding experience to mean there's no me at all. So remember, yesterday we said that we are stuck in the two extremes of existence and non-existence. Now we're stuck in the extreme of existence. We believe there's an independent me here. But if we do this meditation well and we look, and we don't seem to find this independent me, then for us, that seems to imply there's no me at all. Because for us, there only seems to be two possibilities. Either there is an independent me, independent world, or there's no me in no world. So often then, when we get to the point, if we get to the point of not finding, then people misinterpret that as no me at all, and then develop a lot of fear, existential fear. So if you're having this existential fear in this meditation, it generally is a good sign. It means you're doing the search well, correctly, but you're misinterpreting the conclusion. Because remember, not finding the independent me doesn't mean there's no me. It simply means there's no independent me. And the way to overcome any fear, if we have fear that, you know, I don't exist or I'm going out of existence, two ways to overcome. One, of course, is to do more study and reflection and understanding that not finding doesn't mean there's no me. It simply means there's no independent me. So that's one thing we can do. The second thing we can do in the moment when fear arises, we can go, who's having the fear? Because if you don't exist, there can be no fear. So you definitely exist. The fact that you're experiencing fear is proof that you exist. So you exist. Don't worry. Any questions about this? I think this is more or less what you did with Renato yesterday, and you'll do a similar sort of, another similar slight variation of that, but similar approach again this afternoon with Renato.
It's like possible to say there is no car independent on the parts of the car, yeah?
Yeah.
It's the same, there is no me independent on the parts of so-called me.
Right. But
so me appears together with the parts.
Like correct. But like, and so in the text, in fact, it uses a physical object to establish emptiness. So particularly like in the great text from Chandrakirti in the 6th century, he uses a chariot, a cart, and he pulls it apart like I did the pen and goes, where's the cart? To understand there's no cart to be found there. That the cart or the car or whatever exists depending on the parts, but you can't find it in the parts. Similarly, the person exists depending on the parts, the body and the mind, but you can't find the person in the parts.
And then who is experiencing the fear?
The exactly the same car. So the car is not findable in the parts. Mm-hmm. Correct?
Yes.
But you can drive the car. The car exists and you can drive it, can't you?
Paradox.
It's not a paradox. Why is it a paradox? It's only a paradox if we are stuck in the two extremes. If we believe there's only two options, then there seems to be a paradox. So the problem is there's a middle way. There's not just two options. For us now, either there's an independent car or no car. And if we've overcome that the car is not findable in the parts, it seems to be a paradox that it actually works and functions. Only because we believe, wrongly, that if we don't find the car, it means there's no car at all. Then, of course, it becomes a paradox. But there's no paradox. It's just faulty thinking. So there's a middle way. And the middle way is that the car that functions is the car that is labelled depending on the parts. The dependent car. The car that depends on its parts and it exists as something labelled on the parts. That's the car that functions and exists. That's the middle way. Similarly here, the person.
That's the me who is experiencing the fear.
Yeah. So the me, like the car that exists, is the dependent me. There's a dependent car, depending on its parts and labelling, that it functions and drives. The dependent me is the one who's experiencing the fear. Yes, we've got time.
Also the one who's making the search.
Exactly. I mean, of course, there's a me here. There's a me, the dependent me. Otherwise, we couldn't even contemplate anything if there's no me that exists. So the me, like the pen, we said that the pen is not the collection of the parts. You can't find a pen here in the basis. The pen is labelled depending on the parts. That's the pen that exists. Likewise, the person is not the collection of the parts. The person is not the body and the mind. The person is labelled depending on the body and the mind. That's the me that exists. That's not the me that we relate to. We believe there's an independent me here. And that's grasping. We're out of sync with reality. Then the question is, what goes from life to life? What is the agent? Who is the agent? Particularly, what goes from life to life? And I'd like to answer that briefly now. To start the answer, we can go back to a point I mentioned briefly the other day. If we look at just the physical world, there seems to be things moving through time. But if we look very closely at the atomic level, subatomic level, is there anything that moves through time in the physical world? Is there? Or is there just constant flux and change? Hasn't science proven that there's just constant flux and change? There's not one single thing in the entire physical universe that is static. Hasn't science proven that? Physics proven it?
Yeah.
So there's no thing in the physical world that moves through time. It does not exist. Impossible.
Yes.
Science has proven it.
Emptiness.
Emptiness is not a thing.
Oh, right.
So, therefore, at the physical world, there's just flow of change. So then when you ask what goes from life to life, the word go is a bit awkward. Because even at the physical world, there's nothing that goes through time, is there? There's just change. And in that change, to make sense of that, we create objects. In every moment, we create objects to make sense of the flow. But there's just flow. That's it. And we have to create these objects through drawing lines and giving names to make sense of the flow. Likewise, when you ask what goes from life to life according to Buddhism, the word go is misleading. Because it seems to imply there must be a thing that moves through time. But also, like physics in Buddhism, there's no thing that moves through time. Because also the mind superficially seems to move through time. But like the physical world, if we look closely at the mind, it's not a thing moving through time. There's just a flow of change, a flow of experience. That's it. So whether we're talking physical world, mental world, there's not anything that moves through time. So to even answer the question what goes from life to life, a bit awkward. Because the word go implies there must be a thing that jumps from this life to the next. In Buddhism, there's no such thing. Just like in classical physics, there's no thing that moves through time. But what we can answer the question.
Which question?
What goes from life to life?
No, but I had another question.
Yeah, right on. Let's answer this first. So, if we don't understand, if we don't want to interpret the word go, meaning are we looking for a thing that jumps? If we just understand how life to life works, then we can answer the question. So let's say this is our life, this is the body, this is the mind, and let's say this is the present moment. The me that exists right now is a me that is labelled on the mind that exists now and the body that exists now. So this, of course, the me, the dependent me, is the one that's merely labelled. The one that's labelled on the basis of the body and the mind that is here now. Mm-hmm. So this is called often the mere I. Mere I means merely labelled person, meaning not independent. And at every point in this life, we have the me that exists is the one that's labelled on the body and the mind. And even when we go through the death process, we have the same thing happening. Is, from a Buddhist perspective, during the first four stages of the death process, the coarse body and coarse mind are shutting down. So the me that's undergoing that is a me still labelled on this body and this mind. At the end of the fourth stage, the coarse body is shut down. Then the subtle body starts to shut down, which is all the subtle energies and so forth in the body. And that's three stages. So during the stage where the subtle body is shutting down, the me that's undergoing the experience is a me labelled on the subtle body and subtle mind. So that me, of course, is no longer human, but it's still a me. And then at the last stage of the death process, we have the... So that's coarse, subtle, and then very subtle, one stage. Over this last stage, we have the very subtle mind and very subtle wind energy as the body active. So the me that's undergoing the experience is a me labelled on the very subtle mind, very subtle body. Still a me, of course not human anymore. Then in the next phase, we go through this bardo period. this intermediate period between this life and the next, and in that stage we have now a subtle mind and subtle body. And so the Bardo being is the Bardo, the me labelled on the subtle body, subtle mind that's going through at that stage. And then when that mind connects with the fertilised egg and the worm, if we're going to be human again, then we have the next life beginning, when the mind conjoins with the fertilised egg and the worm. So then we have the beginning of the coarse body and coarse mind again. So now the me is labelled on that basis of the body and mind, and now it's human again. So at all stages, there's a me, and that me is merely labelled. So often when the question is asked, what goes from life to life according to Buddhism? The answer is the mere I. But we should not understand that to mean, oh, it's the mere I that jumps from this life to the next. The mere I is not a thing moving through time. It's simply this labelled at all stages on the basis of a body and mind. So that is the answer.
Mere I,
merely labelled person. Like the pen that exists, the pen is merely labelled on the basis. The me that exists, the dependent me, is a me labelled on the body and the mind.
What about the memories? Where are they? How do they go through?
They're associated with the mental continuum. Again, we need to be careful when we talk about memories, karmic imprints. They are not some static thing moving through time. There's nothing moving through time. So as long as we understand that, then it's okay. Then we can talk about memories and imprints and stuff.
I have to tell you, because I remember myself as a kid, up to the age of 10, I think, remembering, telling myself, this is not my life. Someone is showing me this girl's life. And I remember it several times during my childhood. So I had some kind of memory.
Right, but
that came from
Oh, it came from a previous life.
True.
Yeah, I mean, of course the memories stay with that mental continuum. So the Buddhist assertion is all those memories are there. Sure. We just can't connect with them.
What about the Bodhisattvas?
What about them?
That connection, because then it's like,
yeah, but they don't go through the same process here, but they still have, the Bodhisattva is still labelled on the basis of the body and the mind. I mean, they don't go, the mechanism here is a bit different. I mean, they can guide themselves, but they still go through the same thing.
But there is still something there who was primarily, I mean, they do, it's like, if the way you represent Bodhisattvas, they remember everything. I mean, they just change their body, but everything there.
Well, that's because they've purified their mind so they can access those memories, that's all. It's nothing. Anyway, we need to finish. Quick question, if it's
quick. What is the definition of mind in Buddhism? Because it is
clear and knowing.
What?
Clear and knowing.
Mind is clear and knowing.
Yeah, clear and knowing. That's the definition, the simple definition. Clear and knowing. Clear means clarity, means not. It's not the brain, it's not physical, and it allows things to appear in it, and knowing is its function. It's aware of everything.
It seems every one of us, we have our private, separate mind.
Ah, so again, we have individual mind, but is my mind and your mind independent?
It's like an internet.
I mean, no, like, you know, often when people talk about, we have to stop then, but often when people talk about emptiness, they say, according to Buddhism, everything's one. One is dualistic. Because you can only have one if there's two. Big, you can't have big and small. You can only have big relative to small, yeah? But is big and small one? Are they, one means identical. Are big and small one? No. But they're not two. Two means this and this. So therefore, the correct understanding, you're right, you have, your mind and my mind are individual, but your mind and my mind are neither the same nor different. because that's duality. It's like big and small. Mm-hmm. Big and small are not the same, and they're not different, because different means big and small. But they're still big and small. They're individual, but they're not the same, and they're not different. Like that. Okay. Let's break for lunch. Come back at 2 o'clock.